Welcome to the AR Show, where I dive deep into augmented reality with a focus on the technology and uses of smart glasses and the people behind them. I'm your host, Jason McDowell. Today's conversation is a little different. While this podcast primarily explores augmented reality through the lenses of guests, we also seek to discover lessons that apply to life, leadership, and entrepreneurship. Today, we're going to focus less on AR and more on leadership and culture, particularly as they apply to entrepreneurs and their startups. My own background is a three-time co-founder, as an active angel investor, as a senior member of several other startups, and even as a former military officer, has given me a deeper appreciation for the importance of these topics. As a result, I'm delighted to be joined by Keneal Joyce. Like many guests, Keneal has a lot of startup experience. However, her focus is not on creating or investing in an AR-based company, but instead on creating better leaders and company cultures. She's an executive coach who has worked with individuals and teams from Slack, Snap, Amazon, Disney, and even a past guest of this podcast. Keneal received her PhD in organizational behavior from UC Berkeley and was a tenure-track professor at the London School of Economics before shifting her focus back to where her career started, which was on high-growth technology startups. Keneal and I spoke for about 2 hours, and I've split the conversation into two episodes. In this first part of the conversation, Keneal and I talk about what holds many of us back from being exceptional leaders. Here she is in her own words.
The anxiety created by the threat that someone might discover that we're not lovable or that we might have to face that we're not lovable, that anxiety is many people's fuel. It's the gas in their tank, or so they think, and they are very afraid of letting that go.
We also discussed some of her experience as a coach, when startup founders should start thinking about coaching and what to look for in a coach. We also talk about Keneal's own journey and her pursuit of growth. As a reminder, you can find the show notes for this and other episodes at our website, thearshow.com. Let's dive in. Keneal, in your role as an executive coach, what was one of your most favorite moments when working with a client?
Oh, I've had so many. There are a few times in recent past really stand out to me as new favorites. I'd say for each client, I have my own favorites with them specifically. One of my prototypical favorites that's happened multiple times, but it's that moment when at an executive team offsite where we get the whole group of leaders off away for a couple of days. That moment where the linchpin leader, and it may be the CEO, it may be somebody else, realizes that this dynamic that seemed like it was everybody else's doing is actually one that's been repeating in their own lives probably since their early childhood. Hmm. And when they see that and they recognize it in the presence of other leaders who actually at that moment are giving them like unconditional love and acceptance, they can actually withstand kind of just the humanity of being accountable for, of course, like we all do, creating a dynamic around us that replicates it until we can learn it.
So it's that moment where they have the epiphany. The problem may not be external, but internal.
Yes. The one thing that connects the dots is me. Yeah. And it's beautiful because when you realize that, you have traction suddenly. It's not something that's out of your control. And most likely, you actually really have been wanting to figure out how to sort that one out, but it felt like it was totally unrelated from all the struggles that you're currently dealing with at work. And this is why I love working with entrepreneurs, is because because your company is always changing and you need to always change. And you will undoubtedly be presented with opportunities to resolve some of the things that could otherwise hold you back for your whole life. It's just the ultimate school of learning, in my view.
Do you find that entrepreneurs are more open to receiving this sort of introspection, this opportunity to reflect and tackle those problems? Or does it tend to be the more established executives or at more established companies maybe that are more open to this?
I actually find entrepreneurs, if I had to choose, and you know, most of my work is with entrepreneurs, so it's not equally sized data sets on both sides there, but I would say that entrepreneurs are much more practiced at seeking out challenges to their own ego. It's essentially the nature of the sport. And so, yeah, I guess on balance, they are more open in my view. I'm very open to not being right about that. But it's one of the reasons why I love working with entrepreneurs so much is their hunger for self-discovery.
You got your start in your career in consulting and marketing. What motivated you to pursue your PhD in organizational behavior?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that probably the same underlying cause or interests of mine intersected there with marketing and organizational behavior. You know, I was interested. I started marketing when I was in college and worked my way through college. I worked at, first I was a waitress and then I worked at a startup. And that was just my way in. I've always been fascinated by humans and what makes them tick. And in terms of paying jobs, that was what seemed to be readily available to me, were marketing jobs. And once I was on my second or third marketing job, right after I finished college, and I ran marketing at a healthcare startup for about 3 years. And that's where I really became fascinated with the conversation of how are we holding ourselves back as a company? You know, I was watching this company with a brilliant product and service offering, really mission-driven, strong leaders. And the more products, the more customers we signed, the more money we lost, but that was never intended to be part of the model. And we were just really, you know, holding on to the idea that we could pull this out. And I just became fascinated with the dynamics that we were all playing into that were actually preventing us from being able to really be a self-sustaining company. We were venture-backed. And so for some companies, you know, you're not intending to be self-sustaining. But at that point for us, we were. And it was just, that was the conversation I wanted to be in. And I realized that at 24 years old, I was not going to really be in that conversation until I either started my own company or had some more letters behind my name. And I chose to go the letters route. I think I'm, you know, partly just because of some self-limiting beliefs, honestly, about how being an academic in my family was really celebrated and felt safe. And little did I know that academia was going to be totally wrong for me. But it did give me the credibility, I think, just those three letters, PhD, like they do open some doors, which otherwise, you know, may not be as open.
What about it ended up being not right for you, this academic path?
Yeah. So I think this is not unique to academics. I think when you choose a path for egoic reasons, ultimately, your body will teach you a lesson. And for me, it was my back. Probably first my mind and then my back started revolting against academic oppression of being stuck in a chair, you know, for 14, 15 hours a day. And I began to lose feeling in one of my legs. And a few weeks later, I actually couldn't even walk. I was supposed to give a talk in Hawaii at a conference. I had to cancel the trip. And then I proceeded to spend the next 3 years, like basically my whole entire life had to change completely to get my life realigned with what my body wanted from me, which was, you know, movement, like a lot of movement. And it wasn't just about the physical movement. I think it was also just about the, I like interacting with people, and I found academia for me, the teaching bit of it was really, really fulfilling. And I love research, but I wanted to make a more visible impact on people right in front of my eyes. And I had some, you know, I thought to myself, well, I can learn to not need that. It's superficial. And where I kind of landed is there's no right or wrong way to achieve impact in the world. And each of us is kind of wired to think that certain types of activities are just sexy. And I just came to grips with, like, this is not sexy enough for me, to me. And, you know, to others it is. And for some reason, what I want to do is looks different than this. And my body is demanding that I just follow that. Does that make sense?
How far into your time at Berkeley did you discover this? Or was it after you'd taken a teaching position afterward?
Oh, no. I discovered this, let's see, so I was studying for my comprehensive exam. So I guess that was at the end of 2 years that this kind of back problem began to present itself. But I knew, honestly, I knew about 3 months into my first semester at Berkeley that I was not cut out to be an academic.
And so you made the choice then after receiving that PhD and having had this discovery to continue along somewhat of a still safe path.
Oh, yeah.
To be a teacher. Why did you make that choice?
Yeah. So I really did love doing research a lot, and I still do. It's always been a thing. I've always loved doing research. And I really loved my dissertation topic. I was, because of my nature is so creative, I found it difficult to stay on one topic for so many years of my academic life. And that's what's expected. And to a certain extent, it's what's required if you're going to publish and succeed. And I realized if I didn't fall in love with constraints, I was never going to be able to create anything as an academic, and I wasn't going to make it. And I really did want to finish the program. So my dissertation research was all about the effect of constraint on creativity. I decided, you know, just dive right in and learn everything there is to learn about this. And at that point, not a lot of research had actually been done on constraint and creativity. So I loved what I was studying, and I felt it was really important, and I wanted to bring my research out into the world. And for me to finish my dissertation and have a job lined up for me at the end of my doctoral program, it was going to be much more supportive of me to go straight into a tenure track position. So I went on the job market, which you do about a year before you've done. And then I had multiple offers. I ended up going to the London School of Economics for my first tenure track role.
And what did you enjoy most about that position there in London as a teacher?
You know, like always, it's the students. It's the people that you're with. The LSE is a really amazing institution. Students, I would have in one class of 30, I might have students from 25 nations. Very small minority in the Department of Management, at least, are of British descent. I think that's pretty true school-wide. And seeing so many people from so many backgrounds come together to learn about human behavior, and, you know, it could be their first class in negotiations, and getting to break down so many rules that people have been holding for themselves, you know, particularly women around, I shouldn't ask for this thing, or that would be pushing too hard, or if I give a little, then it'll come back to bite me later. And just like actually busting through some of those myths and self-limiting beliefs with actual data on my side. And that is always, the look on people's eyes when they suddenly realize, the cage is in my imagination is, you know, one of my favorite moments.
Did you find that there was cultural differences in the biases that people brought in these sort of negotiating situations,
God,
gender
hugely.
Differences?
And I am, I'm of British descent, right? So my father was born in Scotland. I'm a passport carrying Brit, but I am very American in my style. And I really like to be provocative and to rattle people a bit around their conventions and to shake things up. And so, as you can imagine, I was surprising to a lot of people. And I found that the responses to kind of having boundaries examined and tested was really different based on where people were coming from and their cultural backgrounds. It's hard for me to make specific generalizations about specific countries, but I did find that there's a huge variety of reasons why people end up at a school like the London School of Economics or Stanford or Berkeley. Everyone's got a story, Everyone's got a, you know, your parents worked hard for you to get there. You worked hard for you to get there. There's a reason. There's something that's really on the line for you. And those distinct differences really manifest in really different reactions to being provoked. And that was the fun part to play with.
Any negotiating lessons that you want to pass on to the listeners that you found to be universally true in practice? Maybe not the biases that people brought with them, mm-hmm. but in terms of interacting in that sort of situation?
Yeah. Well, one is what you don't ask for, you won't get. And I think the interesting piece about that is not that people don't ask, but that people actually aren't willing to listen to the answer from themselves about what they actually want.
So they're asking for the wrong things?
Yeah, they're asking for what would I be satisfied with? Rather than what would make me want to just pop a bottle of champagne or host a huge party? What would make me want to open a foundation in my name to celebrate, like, this was my day? And so I think that a big piece of being a great negotiator is being willing to actually let yourself feel the gap between where you are now and where you could be, step one. So you can feel that, like, the tension, the creative tension there between where you are now and where you want to be. But also to see that there is nothing wrong with that desire. In fact, there's, like, tons of creative potential in any desire. And if there's nothing wrong with it and it's just creative potential, then of course, on some level that you just need to find in some way, your counterpart in the negotiation is actually your partner, your creative partner in creating that outcome. There's something great about that outcome for them, just as much as there is for you. And I think that can sound really Pollyanna, but that's the essence of the, you know, the win-win agreement of expanding the pie, is just being willing to explore, like, all of those. Like, what if we don't hold back? What if we actually explore what both of us really, really wants, and we look for the win-win?
Is there a fear that underlies the expression of that desire, even for those that might be willing to acknowledge that there is a gap and that it's an important gap to them that they want to fulfill, but by sharing that the other person is going to take advantage of it and deny it to them?
Yeah. Yeah. So there's often kind of a knee-jerk reaction when you first start negotiating, and, you know, all of us negotiate really all day long for our whole entire lives. We may not recognize it as such. Often we're negotiating with ourselves even. But when we put that label on it, okay, this is a negotiation, there's often this preconceived notion that means that we need to hold back information, that any information we share will be used against us. And I think the fear is, I can't be trusted, they can't be trusted, life can't be trusted.
Sounds like a very sad place to end up.
Yeah. It's subtle. We learn in that place too, you know? We learn in that place. But the fear that, you know, I'm not enough, and if they find out, then they'll use it against me. You can learn strategies and tactics for negotiation all day long, but the context of your negotiation will still be the context of, I'm not enough, and it's a problem, and there's a big threat out there waiting for me, and so I have to hide. So shift the context to, I am enough. It is enough. We are enough. There is enough. Now I'm not gripping so tight onto the outcome, and I can begin to get creative and explore, because I actually don't know where that alignment is between what I want and what you want until we begin to really explore it.
It's only through that exploration can you actually both have a chance of being content.
Yes.
Yeah. After spending this time in London School of Economics, working on negotiation, teaching all these students these insights, mm-hmm. what led you back to consulting?
Yeah. So I came back to the States. So my husband and I conceived our first child in London. We actually had him in London. He was born at our home in Hampstead. And I had a year of maternity leave. My husband was working with Shazam at the time, and he's a general counsel now, working at another gaming company, Scopely, here in LA. At the time, he was legal counsel for Shazam in London. And they had an opportunity for him to come back to the Palo Alto office here and help out with some stuff stateside. We decided to move back, spend more time with family. I was missing my family like crazy. And then we got here and we just decided not to come back, not to go back. It was a really, really exciting time to be in the Valley. I'd always missed the startup culture of, you know, Silicon Valley in particular while I was living in London. And I did advise a couple of really awesome startups while I was out there. But I love just the density of that ecosystem and being on Muni or BART or, you know, Caltrain and just bumping into people and getting to get in really deep conversations about what was happening now, what might happen in the future and where we can all go and all the possibilities. So in 2009, I accepted a role at a startup called Brightly, and we ended up getting acquired about a year later by Groupon. I was heading up growth for them. It was a really interesting time to be at that company. We went through 4 pivots in 6 months, completely tore down products and started from scratch again. A lot of the team went to Groupon. I did not. I, at that point, began consulting. I realized that I'd been in academia now for 9 years, and I needed to accelerate the pace of failure in my career. I needed to, because you learn the most from failure. And so I needed to find a way to fit a lot more failure into my years if I was going to really be masterful. So that's how I began consulting. And I worked with a kind of creative capitalist firm called West, and got to help a lot of companies with that group. And then I just found that consulting was very interesting, but it really wasn't moving the needle on the issues that I wanted to move the needle on.
And what were those issues?
Really, it seemed like almost every consulting issue ended up, especially working with, you know, startups where the founder is still very much involved and you may have, you know, tens of millions of users and you may have tens of millions in the bank and you've got a big team. But the dynamic of a startup where the founder is still deeply involved and it's growing quickly is quite unique. And a lot of the reason why they would end up bringing me or another consultant in was to address a perceived problem. You know, otherwise you probably wouldn't hire a consultant. And at that stage of company, most perceived problems are deeply related to the psychology of the founder. So I realized that a lot of the issues that I was trying to address actually had been created by the person who hired me. And that it was not that it wasn't a problem and that they didn't want to resolve it, but a lot of the leverage was actually in working with the founder, not just working on, you know, the quote unquote problem. And getting into that conversation might just be me and a founder over coffee or, you know, chatting in the lunchroom in between meetings. It might not even be the material of my consulting. So I decided I needed to just get really honest and strip out all of the unnecessary features in my offering and only charge for the thing that was actually creating value, which was a thing I wasn't charging at all to begin with. I had to figure out what that was called, and I guess it was called a coach.
It's almost like you have the unsuspecting arsonist calling you in to put out all the fires that they unsuspectingly started around them. So you identified this thing as a coach, as an executive coach, and begin to really focus on entrepreneurial executives, mm-hmm. in particular, and the founders. So as you have had the chance now to work with so many founders, is there a common thread in the sort of thing or things that tends to hold us back?
Hold us back from what?
From the founder achieving their vision, mm-hmm. which presumably is to create a thing of value for the world. Mm-hmm. At least that's a stated vision to the investors. Mm-hmm. And accomplishing that through the team around them.
Mm-hmm. I haven't found a common thread in what holds us back from bringing our visions to the world. I think it's a lot more idiosyncratic than that. In terms of what holds leaders back, probably most of it rolls up into some form of the ego or the identity, holding on tightly to something that is actually getting in the way of us being truly powerful. The ego is the one that convinces us that if we share information at the negotiating table, that we'll be in danger. When in fact, you can see equally true is the opposite, that if we share information, we will be safe. And, you know, imposter syndrome, loneliness, leadership and management skills, these are all things that come up in almost everybody's coaching work. But typically what it all rolls back up to is we forget how lovable we are.
We forget how lovable we are. Mm-hmm. We're afraid that those around us won't love us.
Yeah. Well, and that we are just not lovable inherently, even if it's not to do with those around us, just from ourselves. And so we go into our organizations looking to like fill this void and repair this wound or solve this perceived problem. And we're acting out all of our ego stuff. And it's never going to fill it, except temporarily. So we create a lot of busyness. Have you noticed how busy a lot of startups are?
Mm.
Very busy. Create a lot of busyness and activity, and it's really, you know, we cycle through distracting ourselves from the nature of our suffering and suffering. And that's not a continuum that is conducive to really like liberating power. And it's not conducive to massive scale creativity or to transformational learning, but it's very conducive to winning.
How so?
Because the anxiety created by the threat that someone might discover that we're not lovable or that we might have to face that we're not lovable, that anxiety is many people's fuel. It's the gas in their tank, or so they think, and they are very afraid of letting that go. So I have, you know, often my first conversation with a new client is them defending to me why it's really important that they continue to be hard on themselves and remain a workaholic. And, you know, it may or may not be true that you need to work 20 hours a week, and I have no preference. There's not a right or wrong answer to that. You know, there's a million ways to create companies that are awesome, you know, that are profitable and have impact. Is that what you want? And for many, it's not what I want. It's the nature of the job. It's what I have to do. And so we begin to buy into these stories about what we have to do. And we architect this whole entire world where like threat abounds and where there is scarcity. And equally true is that there's not. So when we're able to see that, and in fact, like we're all quite lovable and there is a lot of abundance here, then we can start making a choice that comes from an authentic, powerful place of, I actually want to show up to this. And now I can really make some clean decisions. And I don't get caught up in a bunch of drama anymore. That's just me, someone hooking me into like, oh yeah, this is how I'm going to push their buttons. And people don't do it to each other on purpose. You know, it happens to us, you know, all day long. But this idea that we are just inherently lovable is one that I believe we are essentially destined to spend a lifetime forgetting and remembering and forgetting and remembering, because remembering is just feels so good. Waking up to it again feels so good. And so I aim to help my founders to recognize when they've forgotten and then choose, do you want to remember right now?
What's an example of a clean decision?
A clean decision. So a clean decision is one where, you know, I think decisions are essentially agreements. Maybe I'm making the agreement with myself. Maybe I'm making it with another party or several other parties. And a clean agreement is one where I'm making it and no part of me says, this is a bad decision. So I'm genuinely committed to that agreement. I'm going to uphold that agreement. And there will be no excuses around it because I actually want to. So if I said, here's, you know, do you like chocolate ice cream, Jason?
No, I don't.
You don't? What's your favorite treat?
I love chocolate, but not in ice cream.
Okay, you love chocolate.
Uh-huh.
Great. So if I offered you some chocolate, would you have any inner turmoil about accepting the chocolate?
I would.
You would?
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
I have a very strong preference for dark chocolate.
Uh-huh.
I love chocolate so much, I make it at home from the bean.
Ooh.
From single-sourced farms in South America or Central America. And so I find that I do not enjoy milk chocolate at all.
Mm-hmm.
And approach any piece of dark chocolate with a different sort of perspective than I would have several years back.
Got it. Okay. So if you had just created a fresh batch of your favorite kind of single source, single origin chocolate.
I'm really enjoying chocolate from Fiji right now.
Fiji.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing. Would you have any inner turmoil about enjoying a bite?
None.
None. All right. So that's a clean decision, where you are completely on board with it. But what if I were to offer you some milk chocolate?
I might accept out of politeness.
Uh-huh.
But I would not necessarily be very excited about eating it.
And if I sent you home with 10 bars of milk chocolate?
It would be a difficult moment.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Because I would want to say yes, of course, because it's a gift and I want to receive that gift. But at the same time, I'd be thinking, how am I going to properly share this with somebody else who's going to enjoy it a lot more than I.
Right, right. And so that would be an agreement if I had, you know, asked you to agree to it and you said, yes, I will eat these 10 bars of milk chocolate. That might be one that you're entering into a little bit less cleanly. And the chances of you actually following through on it are lower. And there'd probably be quite a bit of suffering along the way. You might be thinking about, what am I thinking of you? You might be judging yourself. Why did I say yes? You know, you might be actually eating it and just, you know, trying to get through it or distracting yourself while doing it or mixing it with something else. And it's a lot. You can see how much more energy it would consume to consume that chocolate because it's not a clean agreement.
Yeah.
Whereas when we make clean aligned agreements as a business, as a leader, then there's a lot less friction and energy wasted.
And what are the keys to getting to a cleaner agreement?
Mm-hmm.
Is it around honesty with ourselves and with others and the ability to communicate that honestly in a productive way?
Mm-hmm. So the first piece is, you know, do I want it? Do I want this? And there could be all different levels of why I would want something. So it could be that I love chocolate, but I really would like to, say, bring down my cholesterol levels. It's easy to talk about this stuff with food. It's just such a clean analogy. I want to bring down my cholesterol levels. So I think to myself, chocolate contains saturated fat. That may make my cholesterol increase. Right now, I'm on a steady regime of lowering my cholesterol, so I'm not going to eat the chocolate. I could do that from a place that's actually empowered, where I really do genuinely want my number to go down. Or I could do it from a should place. I should not eat the chocolate because I should get my cholesterol down. Now, say that those are two different people. Which one do you think is less likely to actually eat the chocolate?
If you are truly committed, you're much less likely to eat that chocolate.
Yeah, because I actually don't want it because I want the outcome on the other side. So wanting is so much more powerful than not wanting. So that's the first step, is what do I actually want? And then the second step is holding up integrity and saying, I am going to do what I say I will do. And as soon as I realize that I might fall out of integrity on any agreement, I'm going to, as quickly as possible, get back into integrity by renegotiating that agreement.
So in a business setting, this can manifest itself as a team meeting in which the leader or the CEO, you discuss a point. We're going to go in this direction. We've learned this bit of data, and now we're going to go that way. Mm-hmm. And everybody around the table just politely nods and says, "All right, chief." And they go and report back to their team. Mm-hmm. But if they don't really believe it, if they don't really agree with that, and they didn't feel that they had fully expressed why they disagree with the decision, that they might be constantly looking for opportunities to subvert or sabotage what that decision was.
Yeah, perhaps unwittingly sabotaging, or just not putting the full your full consciousness and creativity into the effort. I'd actually be really curious about talking to the CEO of that company about, did you notice anything? Did you notice anything different? Did you believe? Did you actually want to know if there was a real agreement, or were you just telling people what to do, hoping that they would agree? And because the place we come from when we're seeking to make actual agreements is a really different place. It's the place where I'm going to actually be very interested in, does your whole body agree to this? There's probably learning. If not, there's probably a lot of learning that is left on the table. Now I can learn about, you know, what are your concerns? Are you, do you not believe that this is where we should be going? Do you believe that there's something that might be in the way that we could overcome? Now, I'm not saying that everyone has to go around having all of these conversations all of the time. It's a choice, and it's not always the most expedient, productive, or even effective choice. But the leader, the conscious leader, will choose which route to do. And they'll say, right now, is it time for me to be effective and expedient no matter what? Or do I want to create alignment? But either way, that person's going to notice, there's something a little bit different here, and I'm not really sure that I got everyone's buy-in, and I'm going to take responsibility for that. It's just about taking 100% responsibility.
You talked about lovableness, that often frequently these challenges emanate from this fear that we are not lovable by others or that we don't love ourselves. Mm-hmm. Where does that originate?
You know, I actually believe that it's kind of just a beautiful piece of being alive. And it's not a problem. It's at least what makes us human, if not makes us primates, if not makes us animals or just living things in general. I mean, what living thing does not need another living thing? I think it's probably quite adaptive, healthy, and actually just factually true that alone we are not enough. So to be reminded of that in whatever form is minimum viable existence. But sometimes we might exaggerate the extent to which that's about us, and we make it a problem. So the fact that I need others doesn't mean that I'm not enough.
We equate one with the other.
Mm-hmm.
We equate a coexistence, if not a dependency on others, with an indication that we ourselves are somehow inadequate as a result. Because if we were adequate, we wouldn't need anybody else. Mm-hmm. Is that the line of thinking?
Mm-hmm. Could be.
Could be.
Or if we were adequate, then everybody would need us.
Hmm.
Takes all different forms.
Yeah. When you are working with clients, I'm sure you have a wide variety of experiences, a wide variety of personalities. Can you share a particularly challenging coaching experience that you faced?
Yeah, it's funny. I don't have a recent memory of one. But I have a lot from when I first got started. Not a lot, but enough. And what they all related to was me wanting to be needed. So when my ego gets involved and I want to be needed, I'm now needing my client to need. And that's the opposite of a coach, in my view. So when my when my ego would get tripped up and I'd want to make sure I provided immediate value and solutions to problems, like now I'm in the land of giving advice. I'm no longer actually supporting my client and seeing them as whole and resourceful and creative, which they are, which all of us are. And now I'm looking for, how is it that you might need me? What's missing over there? And that's not an empowered stance. So one of the things that's really interesting about coaching, which took me by surprise when I got into this, is how constantly a coach is going to be aware of their own need for coaching. It does seem that whatever the issues are that the new layers of my own onion that I've recently unpeeled, inevitably those are the ones that my clients will start dealing with in about 6 months, maybe 3 months, maybe sometimes even that day, you know?
It's a recency bias that shows up in your coaching.
I don't think it's just that. I thought it was recency bias and I was just seeing it and recognizing it. But I actually think it's, I can unearth those things because now I have been there. It's not simply a pattern matching. Mm. And there's probably a ceiling, I would guess, on the level of consciousness that I can support someone in getting to based on my own level of consciousness. And not that there is a clean hierarchy there either, but it's more about what's my willingness to be conscious, aware, and responsible for myself and my own impact, the fullest extent of that impact. And so I need to keep growing if I want my clients to keep surprising me. And I do. And I learn from my clients at least as much as they learn from me. And that's why I love, you know, by nature that, you know, the role of in a coach's world, like you don't get to work with everybody. You get to work with some. And I love being able to select the people that I find just really fascinating. But it's always my own. The challenges have been mine, you know? Mm.
These entrepreneurs are surrounded by a whole cast of participants, supporters, advisors, investors, employees. Mm-hmm. And they're getting lots of advice. Sometimes they're actively seeking it. Sometimes they're just getting it whether they want it or not.
Yeah.
But the very influential group are often the investors. Is there a piece of advice that is commonly given that is just really bad for the entrepreneurs, just something that is fundamentally wrong that they're hearing too often?
The pattern seems to be that investors want bigger, bolder swings. They have a higher tolerance for failure than many founders do. They're more interested in pushing business models to their extreme. And depending on the stage of company, the founder may or may not be there themselves. And at some point, they might become a bit more interested in developing a business model and an organization that is really built for the very long road. Not all, certainly. But I've noticed that the founders who really want to invest in the long term, they can inspire their boards to get on board with that vision to the extent to which they can paint the compelling vision and to the extent to which they come off as really, really committed because they are, and there's a consistency to it, a steadfastness. It gets trickier when, as a founder, you vacillate between sure and doubtful. And then your board begins to want to kind of move the pieces around a bit more just to perhaps to be provocative.
So these are cases where the investors or the board are seeking a particular financial outcome. They've done the math and they realize that it is in their best interest to have, given that many startups fail anyway, those that do succeed to be truly grand slam sorts of wins. And so they're pushing these entrepreneurs to swing bigger.
Right.
Which may be inconsistent with what was true the founder's passion or direction.
Yeah. And that's fine. I mean, they're playing very different games. They have completely different business models. The founder and the VC, they have completely different business models. And it's just good for everyone to be conscious of that and to recognize it. And in my view, like, just talk about that out in the open. That's totally fine. I think it's more, you know, the first time founder, the young CEO who is really has, you know, their friend group no longer understands what they're up to every day. They have few people to turn to for advice or counsel. They're asking, you know, what's normal? What's normal? What's normal? How do I know if I'm like wildly off track or not? They're going to look to any sources of advice and hold on to them a bit more tightly. In fact, or a lot more tightly. And the big distinction between the first-time founder and the second-time founder is how tight they hold on to that advice. So no fault on the VCs for playing that particular game. And it's not how all VCs play either. But it is a dynamic that's inherent in the business model. Yes.
Yeah. You just talked about that your ability to help, your enthusiasm, your what you're able to provide and what you get out of the coaching is enhanced by your own seeking of coaching.
Mm-hmm.
How do you go about doing that for yourself? How have you done that for yourself?
Mm-hmm. yeah, I've done a whole bunch of different things. And, you know, over the years, I've done... I like to give myself challenges. I would say that two of my biggest learning experiences were the births of my two children. And what you learn in the process of preparing for giving birth and then caring for a new baby. I mean, there is no boot camp like that in the world. So I feel really grateful for how much my children have taught me in that process. The intentionally sought coaching, I'd say, I love intense experiences. So I like things like retreats and intensives. I'm actually also part of a group and we meet up once a month. I fly up to the Bay Area for that once a month. And we work with a fantastic coach, Diana Chapman, who is co-author to a book, The 15 Commitments of Conscious Leadership. And I'm in that group with some really phenomenal CEOs, founders, investors, a couple of coaches, and we've just been challenging and supporting each other on this path for the last 2+ years. So that's what I've been up to lately, and that's been completely transformative.
What are the sorts of things that you are exposed to in that sort of learning environment?
I think I'd like to answer that by sharing more what I might be asked to expose in that environment rather than what I've been exposed to. I guess there's, you know, there's models, there's challenges, there's accountability. Just even being reflected back, here's what I heard you say can be really eye-opening. But one of the things that I really am enjoying about this group is how we are leaning into the kind of dare to be as transparent and vulnerable and radically self-revealing as possible. And we did an evening where we did nothing but just share things that we were ashamed about. And shame gets its energy from silence. So when you reveal what you are ashamed of, the shame no longer has power. And it sounds really crazy, and I actually didn't even really believe it until I had done it. And then I found that, you know, a lot of the things that felt like big hangups for me were small and kind of silly. And actually just, you know, another thing that made me. So that's been really fun.
It's really an opportunity to be very holistically introspective and reevaluate all these things that perhaps you held very dear about yourself and realize that some of them might be more important than you originally thought and some much, much less.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So one of the things I've been learning about over the last couple of years is a personality system called the Enneagram, E-N-N-E-A-G-R-A-M. And it's an ancient personality system that essentially gives you a sense of your core personality as well as a path for your growth over your lifetime. And there's 9 types. They're numbered 1 through 9. They also have little titles that go with them, depending on the book that you read. So my type is the type 4. It's the kind of tragic artist type. And what my type likes to believe is that, you know, I am really, really unique and special. And as a result, I will never really have what I want. But the only way to ever get what I want is because of being unique and special. And so it's, you know, every type has its own little catch-22. And that's mine. So shame is a really powerful dynamic for my personality type. Believing that the things that, you know, give us shame are actually really treasures to hold on to. And so we hold on to it a lot. So for me in particular, and there are a few other type fours in the group, it was powerful, fun, really fun.
Speaking of that Enneagram, mm-hmm. why do you like that particular model?
Mm-hmm. Well, at first I didn't. I, you know, being in a recovering academic myself and having, you know, studied psychometrics and, you know, the psychological assessment of personality and understanding just how much rigor goes into validating any peer-reviewed psychological assessment.
Like Myers-Briggs.
Of which the MBTI is not. Myers-Briggs is not in that group. It's a commercial product. So it doesn't have the same robustness in terms of at least statistical validity that others do. But either way, you know, you're familiar enough with these types of tests. And the Enneagram just defies all psychometric principles. Like it's very, very difficult to test the hypotheses that are embedded in the Enneagram because it's a completely interdependent dynamic system. There have been many who have been working on that and trying. So at first, I'm thinking, how can I even believe something that isn't making itself subject to, you know, psychometric testing? It just felt like I was really drinking the Kool-Aid, like major witchcraft, voodoo stuff. And then as I learned more about it and began working with it for myself and then with others, I found that it's one of the most clinically useful tools that I've ever come across. And what's mind-blowing about it is it gives you a little cheat sheet, essentially, to what's the little snake on your shoulder saying? All of us have a little lie that we've been telling ourselves for our whole entire lives that is whispered so constantly and so quietly that we don't even hear it. It's like the air. And then when you wake up and you realize, oh my God, I've been believing that my whole life. That's what's running me. Then you can put it in context and put it in perspective and say, oh, that's just me being a type 4. You know, the type 4, our snake is saying, you'll never really be happy. The type 7, many early stage entrepreneurs are type 7. So this is, they're often the life of parties. They're very futuristic, high energy, high enthusiasm. They've often got tons and tons of friends. For them, the little snake says, it's just around the corner. The best thing is actually the one just around the corner. But the thing is that they're always then rushing off to the next thing around the corner. So all of us have our own little version of this. And when we wake up, then we can suddenly broaden our perspective as well as our personality expression to be beyond just our core type and begin to embody the high parts of all the different types. So I like that it's very practical. It's very insightful when you discover your type. It seems like someone's been literally recording what's happening on the inside of your brain. It's kind of bananas. And it's fun.
Is there a set of characteristics that lend themselves to people who are more open to receiving coaching, to get those that get out of it, more out of it, I should say? Is that another way? Who are the best suited to receive coaching?
The willing. Those who want coaching are the best suited to receive coaching. It sounds simple, and it is. And what hasn't worked is having someone else tell you that you need coaching and then going to look for a coach because you're trying to please the other person. It's just like eating the milk chocolate in our earlier example. If you really only want your own favorite kind of dark chocolate and someone says, well, how about you eat milk chocolate and you actually find the whole thing repulsive, you're not really going to taste it or savor it or try to explore the whole entire flavor and texture of it. You're going to kind of get through it as fast as you can, ignoring as much of it as possible. And that's what happens with coaching. So if someone's coming to me because a board member told them they had to find coaching, I'd explore with them, you know, well, you got on the phone with me anyway, you know, what's going on, and see if they really actually want it. And if they don't, you know, they're actually much better suited not to work with a coach.
Because they're wasting their time?
Not just that, but it can be, the coach can become, you know, a coach who's willing to take on an unwilling client, I would say, you can become an agent of a disempowering dynamic that sees them as broken or needing fixing. And, you know, my question for that coach would be, why do you want to take on somebody who doesn't want this? And what's that about for you?
The lost causes.
Yeah.
When is the right time to receive coaching for an entrepreneur?
Mm-hmm. Early.
Early.
Yes. I think it's, coaching is so common now that it just feels to me like most entrepreneurs in my world start working with coaches at, you know, right in the very early days, and they pretty much always have a coach. You know, for myself, I miss it even if it's been a month. I know that a lot of my clients have said the same thing. So it's the earlier you get started, there's a lot of benefits to it. One is that you begin to flex that muscle of giving and receiving feedback. A coaching session itself is, with me and I know with many others, is a protected time for you to be present. And for some, it may be the only hour that you really are dedicating to full presence. And you're really busy doing a lot of things. You might be paying attention to a lot of things, but it's different than being present without an attachment of where something is necessarily going to go. And that's what makes a transformational coach like me feel different from a strict, you know, performance coach, where you're driving towards a really specific goal. That's not what I'm up to. So it's about presence, and that itself is going to help you be a better leader. But also, your culture is actually being created by you, whether you've made your first hire or not. So the culture of the company that you want to build, it's all going to be a reflection of you and your stage of consciousness. Are you familiar with this concept of projection? So that which we see, there's lots of kinds of projection, but one of the most insidious is that which really bugs us about other people and really just triggers us and gets us like really hot and bothered is typically something we see in ourselves, but we haven't yet been willing to own. And so what our smart little systems do for us as human beings is we will tend to hire all of that part of our shadow, all the parts of ourselves that we don't own, we'll tend to hire it in other people. Okay, I hate the part of myself that gets angry, so I don't ever want to let myself get angry, but I need to have somebody else around here get angry because, you know, there's people here who aren't doing their job and I'm not willing to confront them, so I'm going to hire a heavy, or I need a COO to fix all my people problems. And then you bring in more people, and then those end up being kind of your worst nightmares in lots of ways and your best teachers, but you can never escape yourself. So the earlier you start coaching, the more consciously you can create that culture and the more it's going to actually be supportive of you as the leader.
You'd mentioned that there's two different distinct types of coaching. Can you go into those a little bit more? Performance-oriented mm-hmm. coaching versus transformational-oriented coaching. Mm-hmm. What are the objectives of mm-hmm. each?
I think there are, you know, probably hundreds of kinds of coaches. In the executive coaching variety, a lot of folks, especially if it's a board member who's wanting to find a coach for, you know, a troubled founder, they're often wanting a performance coach who's going to help someone to, you know, do a better job in a along predetermined benchmarks or standards. So this person needs to get better at time management. This person needs to get better at public speaking. And there's a way you can approach that that's a performance-oriented way where you're going for more wins and something that you want to measure and track. And then there's another way that's going to maybe it's going to let go of the timeline. They're going to be willing to take the longer way around to get to the root of the issue. And that could be at the level of just, you know, some profound insights and aha moments, or it could be at the level of, you know, cellular level, which is the level I try to work at, where you're actually beginning to rewire your nervous system so that you can be more interested in creating than in being a victim. Meaning, and so those of us that are like addicted to, I need to kind of whip myself into shape all the time and push. And my anxiety is actually my fuel and I need it in order to succeed. And if I don't succeed, I'm not safe. And my father doesn't love me and I don't love me and blah, blah, blah. You know, they create two really different kinds of companies. and it's undoing all of that nervous system training that is part of growing up in a high achieving society. And there is a way to be even more successful when you let that stuff go. So I work at the cellular level. I would say that's the difference, transforming the body.
What makes for a great coach? Mm-hmm. Specifically, if we're going to focus on the type of coaching that you focus on, mm-hmm. what do you think are the attributes that make for a great coach? Mm-hmm. From the perspective of helping those out there who might be seeking somebody, some help, mm-hmm. like what are the sorts of criteria that they should use to identify a coach for them?
Yeah. So if you're looking for a coach, I'd look for someone, you know, first and foremost, like that turns you on in some way. There's something about them, maybe you can't put your finger on it, that just excites you. It's because what that's doing is it's tapping into your actual desire, your willingness. There's something about them that's bringing out in you some of your most creative energy. From that place, you're going to be willing to let go of some of the patterns that have been holding you back in the past. From that place of, wow, there's something so compelling over there. Even if I can't see it clearly, there's something so compelling in my future and I want to go towards it. So you want to be around someone energetically who just really excites you, who scares you a little bit. So that's like the chemistry piece is a combination of those. Someone who feels like they're your intellectual caliber. Someone who's going to challenge you and call you out on stuff to the extent that you are willing to be called out. And that's why, you know, best coach for one is not best coach for all. I really trust each person's own inner instinct about who's the right coach for them. You have a much better sense of who you're ready for and who you're not. And it doesn't mean that you're not further along. I mean, there's definitely such a thing as compatibility and style. Things that don't matter as much in my view are domain expertise, unless you're specifically looking to learn some, you know, really domain-specific skills. And then the certification. So coaching is becoming more of a certified profession, and I think that there are a lot of positive things about that. However, at the stage that we're at right now, and I'd say for the next few years at the very least, it's not difficult to become a certified coach, but certainly is time intensive and it's also expensive. So I would focus more on, can this person wake me up to something in the first hour I spent?
And so the only way to really find a good coach in that case is to go and try a few.
Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes you can tell, you know, you can read something someone's written and you can just have a sense like, oh, that's something about this one I just really like. You know, and everyone's different. I mean, you know, if you're a highly intellectual decision maker and you're very analytical, then of course that's how you're going to want to make the decision. It's personal. But chemistry matters.
Chemistry matters.
Mm-hmm.
I continue my conversation with Camille in the next episode. She shares one of the most transformational moments in her life and what she learned from it. We also dig into company culture, how to know when a culture is working, when it's not, and when yours needs a tune-up. I think you'll love the rest of the conversation. Please subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss this or other great episodes. Until next time.